So good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Think of all the other things you could be doing, and you're here. It's wonderful, and we're very fortunate. And I cannot help but mention the Prajnaparamita statue on your altar. I think that's wonderful. Well, this may sound a little irreverent, but I'm a great fan of hers. And I have a statue of her right inside the front door of my little hermitage. And I think she's been too long neglected. And so I'm grateful to see you honoring her here. So a while back, I asked Jim Hare if he had any suggestions as to what I might talk about tonight, thinking perhaps there was, you know, something on your minds. And he said, well, actually, it often works best if someone just talks about the cutting edge of their practice. Now, I'm actually not sure he said that, but that's what I heard. And so that's what you're getting. And, you know, when I kind of sat down with myself and said, so what is the cutting edge of your practice? What came up was despair. And so I'm going to talk about despair tonight. Despair, disenchantment, and enchantment. And, you know, despair has affinity with words that begin with dis. Disaffected, disappointed, disillusioned, things like that. And I think that despair can be an easy default setting for some of us these days. And all we need to do is look at our world, right? And I'm not going to go through the litany because we all know it. But I can get pretty bummed. And I'm talking about despair, by the way, and not depression. So those are two different things. And I don't know a lot about depression, actually. Maybe I'm lucky. Anyway, so our world. And also, for me, there's a lot of despair that I experience over the impact of human beings on our natural environment. I love the world of nature. And, you know, even a footpath disrupts the world of nature and the communities that nature lives within. And, of course, we're part of that, too, and so we need a place there. But I can find it hard to bear sometimes when I see what we've done to our natural environment. And then there's old age, disease, and death, right, which none of us can escape. And I'm thinking of my own, but I'm also thinking of those around me and what they're going through, you know, as we all age. And it can take its toll. It can take its toll. And then there's the question or questions that arise for me, like, is life any fun anymore? Or is it meaningful? Or is it too stressful? Or too painful? I mean, really, too painful. Sometimes I just want to sit down and cry. And sometimes I actually do sit down and cry, to be honest with you. And how much do I really want to bear? Do I want to keep bearing all of this? But, you know, then there's practice and training. And you know, after fully sitting within what it is that leads me into despair, I remember a monk very senior to me many years ago at Shasta Abbey when I was newly ordained, really. He said, you know, and I wasn't talking about despair then. I was mad then. Forget despair. Anyway. he was talking about despair, and he said, you know, despair is a breakage of the precepts. And that really stopped me short, because we don't have a, you know, we have a precept that I don't know what you're, how you verbalize them, but we have one that says, do not be angry. I mean, I think you have some version of that. We don't have a precept that says, do not despair, or do not be despairing. And so that really stopped me short. And I reflected on that, you know, I thought about, well, isn't despair a way of taking life, taking the life out of things? Or isn't despair lying? Is despair really true? And so in working and training and practicing with despair, the precepts became sort of a first recourse, if you will. What do I need to do given the precepts? But I also began to recognize it for myself that it's not about despair as much as it's about disenchantment. It's not that seeing what I see leads to it's awful and it will never be better. It's actually that it leads to no wish to cling. And clinging for me, in a sense, had become too painful. Do you know how that feels in your body, clinging? I mean, I'm sure you've meditated on this. And the real shock for me came, actually, I absolutely love the mountains. That's what I think of as home. My whole life has been trying to get there and never quite doing it, you know, never quite succeeding. And so instead I go hiking, right, up in the mountains. And I get up in the mountains and it's like, oh, I'm home. This is wonderful. I'm at ease. I'm content. And then one day I went hiking and it was like, oh yeah, this is just more of the same world, you know. I don't mean that in a like pessimistic, blue, gloomy way. It was just, it's not pulling me like it used to. And I'd like to, you know, maybe this is too much of a pat on my own back, but I'd like to think that it was letting go of the clinging to the mountains that changed how they appeared for me. And I labeled that disenchantment. Disenchantment with the mountains, with all of the, with everything that's, that arises in the world, you know, with everything that is here, that comes to us. And I think this is part of coming to know deep in our guts that there is no lasting happiness in compounded things, as the Buddha taught. And in fact, he spoke. He didn't write anything. He spoke about disenchantment quite a bit in the Pali Canon, actually in later sutras too, but I'll just read you one passage. Pleasant feeling is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away, and ceasing. Painful feeling too is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away, and ceasing. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and you know in Buddhism we have these three kinds of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, neutral. So neither painful nor pleasant feeling too is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away, and ceasing. Seeing thus, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with pleasant feeling, disenchanted with painful feeling, disenchanted with neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. He understands, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So, the reason the Buddha is giving in this passage for disenchantment is impermanence. Everything that arises is impermanent, and therefore there's no point in being too attached to it. And, you know, we all know that clinging and attachment are a primary cause of suffering. But also, he talks in other passages about how the construction of self is a reason for disenchantment. When we give up constructing a self, this is not what, you know, when we recognize this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, with regard to everything that exists, disenchantment arises. And isn't it the self that ultimately we cling most steadfastly to, grasp, hold close, don't want to let go of? This grasping that's the cause of suffering. And isn't despair all about me? Really, you know, when I'm sitting there in despair, it's all about me, how I want the world to be, rather than accepting what the world is, accepting it as it is, and thinking I know how it should be, and thinking it all ought to change to match how I think it should be. Now, in that passage I just read you, if you noticed, the Buddha says that disenchantment leads to dispassion. And in another passage, he says that dispassion leads to equanimity. So this is getting to be a pretty rich resource, isn't this, for our ongoing practicing with the Dharma. Now, I think it's important. I want to talk about dispassion for a minute. I think it's important not to confuse dispassion with indifference, which is its near enemy. I don't know if you heard this phrase, near enemy. I love it. I think it's a Theravadan tradition thing, but a near enemy is something that looks like something but isn't it. And so indifference would be a near enemy of dispassion, and you can see how dispassion could look like indifference. But indifference is dead, isn't it? And dispassion is not. Dispassion is the aliveness that comes when we let go of the clinging and attachment to all the things around us, to how we think the world should be, how we want it to be. But, you know, actually, I pride myself on being passionate. I mean, who wants to be dispassionate when, you know, you can... And isn't Zen passionate? I mean, in each moment that we're present for, you know, in our meditation practice, in our daily life, isn't there a passionate, intimate engagement with what is? That's how I kind of see it, you know? And yet, the Buddha's pointing us towards this dispassion. But isn't this what Zazen is? Or, you know, this passionate or intimate engagement with what is? Or is Zazen removed? Is it sitting down in right in the midst of life? Or is it detached from life? And I think we know the answers to those questions. Actually, sitting down in the midst of despair, because our Zazen teaches us that when something like despair arises and we want to get rid of it or fix it, which is certainly what I try to do, it's my first impulse, let's get out of here, let's make this better, you know. When we sit down right in the midst of despair, that's our Zazen practice. And we don't insist that it go away, but just let it be there as it is and actually come to know it intimately. Come to really know what it feels like in the body, what kind of thoughts and emotions arise in response to it. So there we are sitting in the midst of despair, and this is what the Buddha is calling dispassion. Not wanting it to be different, not trying to change it. actually being willing to be intimate with it and be close to it. Now, which leads me to equanimity, because you know equanimity has to do with things being equal, and we tend to prefer one thing to another, you know. But in fact, I would submit that we actually love all things. We love even what we hate, if you will. And we love all things equally. And I would challenge us to take this leap. I mean, I guess I could say for myself, this is the whole point of my practice. Not that I'm there, I may never get there. And I'm sorry about the microphone. I guess I just really clunked it. But can I love all things equally without attachment and without clinging or grasping or hurting, passionately, fully engaged with dispassion, with all that there is that in existence? So what happened to me is I immersed myself in despair in order to explore what this was about in my training. The very moment and thing that I was immersing myself in, or even had aversion to, the very circumstances that I'm relating to from this place of dispassion, morphed into the miraculous, if I can put it that way. So every single present moment, we know the present moment's infinitely short, right? Every single present moment, it was like it was doing this from awful to miraculous, you know, from that which causes despair to that which gleams with brightness and sparkle. And, you know, life isn't always like that. But sometimes that kind of thing arises, you know. And in fact, every moment is miraculous. And one cell of the body is miraculous. One cell of the body is miraculous, never mind the whole body. You know, the whole body is phenomenal. And this one body here is an infinitesimally small part of the universe, right? So I'm walking through the supermarket parking lot, right, which is for me a place of despair and aversion. Some people like to shop. I'm not one of them. But I'm noticing the trees and also the cars and the pavement. But I know, and of course this is my conceptual thought, but I know that trees breathe out oxygen, and I know that I breathe out carbon dioxide, and the trees breathe in carbon dioxide, and I breathe in oxygen. So we're trading breath. It's, you know, it's really, to me, mind-blowing to think of this. We are trading our breath with the trees and the plants. I mean, what could be more intimate than that? And so completely right. It's like I almost can't breathe just thinking of it. And how can there not be joy when we recognize this, the truth of this reality? And we creatures are all doing this together, and we can't survive without each other. You know, I mean, we humans can't survive without each other, but we can't survive without the trees and the plants either. Whether they can survive without us, that may be more likely. Now, I said that how can there not be joy? And I want, well, you know, I consider joy actually to be a moral imperative, and I hope you'll forgive me for putting it that way. But it really doesn't matter how pessimistic I am about the future of the world or its present situation or how miserable I may think that life is or someone else's life is or what a mess we've made of things and all of that that leads into despair. I can always, in this one moment, find joy. Always. And it's crucial that I do so, because how we live in this world matters. Being kind to each other matters. I have to tell you, this is my mantra. Be kind, be kind. Being kind to each other matters. 1 second of kindness matters. It affects everything. And we can never ignore this. And that's why I say that being joyful is a moral imperative. We're responsible for this. What kind of world are we going to create? And I think, you know, our practice puts it right on that razor's edge where our karma comes to us, but then we're responsible. And in that moment of responsibility, we take action. And the question to ask is, what kind of world are we going to create? Now, as I was reflecting on all of this and what I might say tonight, I noticed that in the very moment of despair or dispassion, a deep love, I mentioned love earlier, a deep love for this world and for this moment or for whatever was arising also arose. So that kind of miraculous, that sense of miraculousness in the moment that seems awful and yet it's miraculous. So simultaneously, love and joy were arising, appreciation, awe, a sense of mystery. It's kind of like the Sandokai, really. I don't know what you call the Sandokai. Thank you. Exactly. Within all light, now this is my translation or our translation, but I think you'll recognize it. Within all light is darkness, but explained it cannot be by darkness that one-sided is alone. In darkness there is light, but here again by light one-sided it is not explained. Light goes with darkness as the sequence does of steps in walking. Despair, joy, darkness, light. It's like a Mobius strip. How many of you are familiar with Mobius strips? Almost everybody. I brought one tonight, so you don't have to be familiar with Mobius strips. I think Mr. Mobius was the one who came up with this some time ago. Anyway, this is a piece of paper that's different on both sides, which helps with Mobius strips because you need to see when you're on which side of the paper. And what you do with this is you, if I can make it work, put a single twist, a half twist, a kind of half twist into the paper, connect the ends, and then if I had like, you know, a magic marker, and this paper unfortunately has been folded, so it's going to be a bit recalcitrant, but if you have a magic marker and you start, I'm starting on this white side, right, and I'm tracing down the paper, and I come up this other white side. When I get up here, suddenly I'm on the other side of the paper. And now I'm on the colored side, going around the colored side. And if I trace it around far enough, I come back to the white side. So you're constantly flipping from one side to the other. And I'm, in my own mind, using the word morphing here. You know, the despair morphs into the joy. The joy morphs, or the darkness morphs into the light, and the light morphs into the darkness. So it's a little bit like that, if you relate to visual images. Frankly, it gives me vertigo, this whole shifting and changing, you know? But so much of Zen is about holding paradox. And that might be why we have such a rich koan tradition, you know. But the koan arises in everyday life, right? We don't need the old stories, even though they are tremendously helpful. But in a sense, practice is all about being open-handed, open-hearted. And you can think of this as, you know, holding your hands up with the palms open. And on one hand is despair, and on the other is love, joy, intimacy with this present moment. You know, that's kind of a... And we hold them both at once. We hold them absolutely both at once. This way of talking about it is maybe a little too dualistic. You know, we don't like dualisms. But it does make a point. And the point, you know, both are here at once, absolutely at once, not even in sequence. You know, the Sando Kai talks about the sequence of dark and light, like the steps in walking, or the Mobius strip is a sequence, but they're not even in sequence. They're absolutely right here, both at once, meshed in each other, you know? So can we sit in that and not use our thought to divide up the world? Can we actually be both at once, the despair and the joy? Can we be both at once? So, because I can't quite help myself, I'm going to bring in something else that may not sound quite relevant, but for some reason I've decided that it is. So I hope you can follow my train of thought here. This is, you know, Khon Edjo, Dogen's disciple, is reputed to have written, well, it's what is said is that we have one thing that he wrote that has come down to us. There are those who think he wrote a lot, but we only have one thing, and it's called Komyozo Zanmai. So Zanmai is something like samadhi, and Komyozo is treasury of radiant light. Komyo is radiant light, and Zo is treasury. So that was the title of this piece he wrote, The Samadhi of the Treasury of Radiant Light. I think that's a good start right there, you know. But quite a long time ago, back in 1985 actually, Shohaku Akamura translated the last section of that little piece of writing. More recently, he translated the rest of it. But back in 1985, he translated the last section, and one line that occurs very near the beginning, I just love it. The way he translated it is, cast your body and mind into the radiant light and don't look back. Isn't that wonderful? Sometimes I think, that's the only instruction I need. You know, that's it. Anyway, I think this is actually a very apt description of right effort. Right effort enables us, when despair arises, to move towards this despair, to sit within it fully and intimately, to experience the joy that arises as a result, and to live within the mystery that our life is. That's what right effort leads us to. So I'm not sure I've actually given a Zen talk, but this is what I have to say to you tonight. So I thank you for being here and for listening. And I'm hoping that you have thoughts, comments, questions, your own experience. What do you do with despair? I mean, I know I'm not alone in this. So, yes.
You gave it to me.
Oh. Well, you can. Thank you for witnessing the state of our memory. I'm quite taken with your talk on despair. It's something that I've experienced quite intimately several times in my life. And the first thing that came to mind was that true despair, I think, is the abandonment of right effort. Because when you're down there, there is no place to go. And you know, there in the Nikaya somewhere, there's this passage, I quoted it in the last talk I gave here, where I don't remember all of it, but the first line of it is that life in any world is uncertain or unstable and is swept away. And it took me, you know, 30 some years to find practice after being in the depths of despair. But I think we pick ourselves up and practice despite these things. Is that clinging? Probably. But what are you going to do?
Better to cling to something that helps than something that hurts.
Yes, yes, definitely. But thank you so much for your talk. It was quite profound.
You're welcome. You know, despair, dis, you know, is away from or not. I'm talking about the etymology here. And the spare part has to do with hope. So despair is no hope. And it's funny, I didn't talk about hope at all in this talk.
Just did.
So I'm taken that you see this connection between right effort. You know, the way to train with despair is right effort. And right effort implies some hope. I mean, we're able to make the effort because some little part of us has a bit of hope there, even when we feel like we've bottomed out. No? You look skeptical.
Well, I have to admit that it took some period of time before right effort made itself apparent.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of wrong effort available out there.
Right. Unfortunately. No. Are you on?
Yeah.
There we go.
Fine, thank you. Yeah, it struck me what Clem just said that you didn't, and you mentioned it, you didn't mention the word hope. In the tradition I was raised, the three what are called theological virtues are faith,
hope, and charity.
Yeah. And the reason they're called theological is because having them or practicing them touches us to the absolute directly. And so you might say that the final sin against hope would be despair. I don't know if it's actually despair or giving in to despair. I think maybe that might be a better distinction.
Yeah, nice distinction.
In the Christian context, the two examples that come to mind of what of Jesus freely accepting his death and Judas, who betrayed him, hanging himself in despair, presumably. And what the image came to mind, those of you mentioned a rope, you know, is that we grab a rope to pull ourselves up out of despair, or we can use it to end our life.
Yeah.
And I have hope that even those of us that have tried or succeeded at that, There's always hope for us, for them. But I will say that I just love your image of the Mobius strip and the fact that we live in this tension of hope and despair, of dark and light, of sadness and joy. And that's truly, I think, just what stretches us every which way. It's the shape of the universe. I really do think that.
It's not about getting rid of any of those. It's about living intimately with them.
Yeah, including them both and transcending them in a certain sense.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what you said about suicide is important, that there's always hope for everyone. And if someone who is dear to you commits suicide or even attempts it, it's so painful. But I think if we can remember that even after they've died, you know, who knows? Who knows what comes to them? Yeah.
Just one more thing that I'm sorry, I'm alluding to all these New Testament images, but it's my background. But it's referred to as the sin against the Holy Spirit. which is the only unforgivable sin. And a lot of people just are like, what does that mean? What does that mean? You say something nasty about the Holy Spirit and you're done. That's it. You're zapped. Forget it. You're toast. It's a lot of reflection on this, but it's this idea of imputing no good to anything, that there simply is no good, or to look at goodness, to look at compassion, joy, love, all the things that we receive as the precepts and so forth, the Buddha Dharma, the way of Christ, as evil, or to do evil in the name of those things, justifying it as good. Which, of course, it's like we have the vice squad, but we don't have a virtue squad. We need a virtue squad because there's an awful lot of people running around the world doing shit, that they are sure is the right thing.
Yeah, and I do want to comment on what you said about the reason they're theological. I'm struck by that because they touch the absolute. And isn't that something? And we don't have the same concept of a God in Buddhism, but there is something greater than ourselves, isn't there? And we touch that. And that, actually touching it is available to us in every moment if we turn towards it.
Well, you mentioned the breath of the trees. And
yes.
It is the divine breath.
Yeah.
It is the divine breath, in my opinion.
You have a microphone already.
Always ready. My go-to reference for despair, I can't help but mention, is Macbeth's tomorrow and tomorrow
oh.
and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, and all our yesterdays have lit fools the way to dusty death and the rest of it. Reverend Vivian, your talk is so comprehensive and heartfelt and intimate that I don't know what to ask. But I would accept, I would ask, because I loved your image of being open-handed mm-hmm. with the world. Open-hearted, open-minded, and carrying the light and the dark at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to say it, the right foot and the back foot, because that's how language is. But we know they're always intimately connected. But our minds have such a tendency to discriminate. It's right. So useful to categorize and so forth. What is it that happens when we hold, when we can hold them both at the same time?
We touch the absolute. Or our hearts break open. Our hearts break open.
Yeah, sometimes we laugh and sometimes we cry.
Yeah. And sometimes those two are the same thing. Yeah.
Like the Ouroboros, the Mobius strip, the Ouroboros.
Yes.
The serpent.
That bites its own tail?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you for your talk. Very wonderful. Appreciate it very much. You talk a lot about something that's been a koan for me for years, which is how do you practice in shikantaza with emotions? How do you, what's your sense of that? How do you do it?
Well, I kind of said it in the talk. I think this is a really important question, because I don't think Zen is about getting rid of our emotions. I don't think it's about flatlining emotionally. You know, I think that would be a really dead way of living. And I think our practice brings us alive. And so the way to do it is to really sit in the middle of them. You know, so when despair arises or when anger arises or when grief arises, go right into the middle of it. Don't try to go around it, over, under, you know. Go right into the middle of it and just sit there with it and feel it. Feel it totally. Feel it with your whole body and mind and heart. We tend to want to tamp them down or avoid them in some way or make them go away. But when we go right into them, you know, one Joko Beck, actually, Zen teacher, said that if you are sitting in the middle of your anger, you can't cause any harm with your anger. And of course, we think if we, our anger can be so ferocious and destructive, so we think that if we go towards it, we're going to cause damage. And we're not supposed to cause damage, right? We're not supposed to hurt anybody. We're not supposed to break the precepts, all that stuff. But in fact, if you really can sit in the middle of the anger and feel it fully, then, well, whatever happens, happens. The anger doesn't necessarily instantly disappear. But my experience is that with time it morphs. And, well, there's that word morph again, you know. It somehow becomes much more spacious. You know, the problem with our emotions is that we can get so averse to them because they scare us that we tighten around them. Or we kind of go nuts with them, you know. Worldly joy, for example, or greed, you know, you can just go nuts with it. But when we can let go of that tightening around them, and just let them be free in who we are. So just be there with it. If it helps, think of sitting down for a cup of tea with your anger or your grief or your, you know, sometimes that image helps. we really want to be their friends. I think that's crucial. We really want to be their friends. We so often try to oppose them and get rid of them. And it's so important to not see them as bad. We think they're bad and that we're bad for having them. And the thing about, I mean, we really think we're bad if we're angry, right? I think the thing about anger is that it's trying to teach us something. It's trying to tell us something. And if we listen carefully enough, we'll actually hear what it's trying to teach us. And then we can use the energy of the anger to act appropriately, rather than destructively. So the anger morphs into that which is helping us. Does that help at all? Does, you know? And so Shikantaza, which is about sitting with what's here right now, this minute, is very much to the point. You know, it really is.
Yeah, no, very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you for the question. Did you have a question? No, okay. Jim had a question or a comment.
Yeah, well, your talk made me think of, it was Karen and I, my wife and I, were in a restaurant Sunday, I guess, and yesterday, and there was a very odd sign in this restaurant that said in Spanish, "Tu diferencia contamina." Your indifference pollutes, essentially.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it was kind of like this big sign, and it was a very odd sign to see in a restaurant. Your talk kind of reminded me, you know, what about that, and what would I mean, I've been sitting here kind of thinking, well, what's the right response to that? But rather than me say, what do you say?
What's the response to?
I mean, what's response to that view?
Okay.
What would you say is the
indifference
response?
Indifference pollutes. What's the response?
What's your response?
Well, the response is yes. let's drop off our indifference. I mean, it's not complicated, is it? What's your response?
Well, I was thinking, you know, what would I say as a kind of alternative view, and it would be something like your engagement, without clinging, cleans things up.
There you go. There you go. And yeah, or your engagement creates love. And you know, I think you can guess I'm not using love in the romantic sense or the sense where, you know, we have a lot of preferences for something and so we love it. I'm using love as this kind of open-heartedness that leaves nothing out. It's completely all-inclusive, you know. So your engagement is love, right? Yeah, that's a good response. And it, you know, it corresponds to the comment.
How do we say it in Spanish?
I don't know.
Yes, you did say it.
Su conexión crea el amor.
There you go. Good enough. I don't know Spanish. Please.
Thank you for your talk. I found a lot of meaning in it, particularly today, for instance. It's my last day in a community where I really felt a lot of belonging, but it's not meant to be a place where people stay permanently. Mm-hmm. Your stay is temporary, and then you move on. Mm-hmm. And it's a space where I've witnessed, you know, a lot of suffering from the other people there, but also a lot of kindness and compassion as well. The duality really strikes me in all the things that I've seen there and the conversations I've had with people. And I guess I don't know if it's, maybe you've already answered the question, but I guess, I'm just feeling a lot of despair over the transition. And I'm feeling fear about being able to take the lessons that I learned there into, you know, and apply them in my larger life. Trying to sit with those feelings that feel really overwhelming right now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to take a step back for a second and just say that, you know, people who suffer deeply are also deeply compassionate, because the suffering brings you to the compassion, doesn't it? Which you've experienced with those people, which is part of what makes it so hard to lead. But in response to your fear, I would say have confidence in yourself. You can do this. You can do it. And yes, it brings up fear, you know, and again, and despair. Again, there's the sitting in the middle of it. And I would really encourage you to trust that, you know, when we truly sit in the middle of something and feel it fully, we think it's going to take us down, but it actually doesn't. That's kind of the miracle of it. So trust that and trust yourself, because I think you can do this, and the fear will arise and you can bear the fear and you can move through it. You know, you can walk straight through that fear and out the other side and begin doing whatever you need to do so that the fear is not stopping you. And that can be very small steps. Just take one step at a time. What's the next thing? Do that next thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And something about your talk that's really kind of gotten me to a more subtle understanding of clinging.
Uh-huh.
And the exquisiteness almost of
yes.
everything that arises is free to arise and go away. But there is ways that I can see that I cling without even knowing it, even just to a thought or a worry or something like that. And it's like exhilarating almost to feel the potential
yes.
of not clinging but being with everything that's arising.
Yes.
Because there's this constant movement of our lives that want to keep moving and live.
So absolutely.
Thank you.
And you know, clinging can be exquisite. I mean, there's a subtle it's like with me in the mountains. I can be like, well, I'm not clinging to the mountains. I'm just enjoying the mountains. And I think that's an important distinction. You know, we're not clinging to chocolate ice cream just because we like it, so we have some. We can be clinging to it, but, you know, it's fine to enjoy things. That's not clinging. But but I could recognize in myself this subtle, maybe not so subtle, but to me it felt like a subtle kind of clinging, like, I want this for me, you know. So the clinging has this exquisite and subtle side to it. And, you know, you brought up something that came up for me with some earlier comment about the exquisiteness of it when we let it all come and go. We can think that impermanence is our enemy. It's our friend. You know, life would be miserable if things weren't impermanent, quite frankly. You know, and life is this arising and falling away, arising and falling away, morphing, changing, shifting. And it's really beautiful. And we can think of it as dancing. We're dancing with it, you know?
I can catch myself clinging to the thought that I shouldn't feel so much joy.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like all extremes, all everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get, isn't it funny how we can think we're bad for being joyful? Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.